Castle, episode 647, for October 6th, 2020. The South China Sea, by Zora Mai Kun. Rated R. Welcome to Podcastle. I'm your host, Setsu Uzume. Today's story was previously published in the Genius Loci anthology, and it was both written and will be narrated for you by Zora Mai Kun. Zora Mai Kun is a genderqueer Vietnamese writer whose short stories, essays, and poems can be found in The Sea Is Ours, Genius Loci, The Spirit of Place, POC Destroy Science Fiction, Luminescent Threads, Connections to Octavia Butler, Strange Horizons, Terraform, Glitter Ship, Mithila Review, and Quelly Journal. Their website will be in the show notes. And now, hold tight to the people you love, and enjoy the story.
The South China Sea, by Zora Mai Kun, read by the author. There in the fragmentation of raindrops during monsoon season and the quivering of evaporating dew in the dawn of sea salt mornings, I am intimately familiar with them, for I have always been surrounded by spirits. Our village was built around a cemetery abandoned during the war. That was where we migrated to when our hamlet was massacred and over 1,000 lives lost. Ghosts were seen as regularly as any villager wandering through the tombstones in our gardens, passing the evening dinner table and swirling in the incense in our temples. I often caught a glimpse of them in the air, as if in shards of broken glass, with them always lingered a scent. It was this same scent that permeated the air when we drifted into the crest of the South China Sea. It was intermingled with the smell of misery and remorse and the taste of sweetened rust, as if you plunged an abandoned nail into sugarcane and then sucked on it for days on end. I knew then that we had ventured into that ghostly stretch of sea in which the souls of people still lingered aimlessly, struggling against the powerful wave, gagging at the descent of salt water into their lungs, playing out their deaths over and over again as if their hope for life somehow continued long after their demise. As soon as her swells began to coil around the boat, I felt the mood on board shift. Elders grouped together above us on the deck to set up a small altar. Damp joss sticks were lit and inserted into nicks in the wood, and muffled invocations whispered.
Let us pass in peace, dear mother.
From the darkness of the cabin below, I felt them pass through me, the victims of the sea, friends and families and strangers. Twice she had beaten me, swallowed my brother and sister, captured scores of people in my village, and betrayed my father.
I hate you,
I whispered to her. I thought I heard her whisper back to me. But it was only the sound of her salty tentacles rippling against the rotten wood of our fishing boat. My back was turned to her as I methodically dumped the mixture of bile, feces, and urine that had been collected in the buckets kept at various corners of the small boat. She felt uncharacteristically calm, a quietness that made me nervous. I averted my eyes from her, focused on my task. The mere sight of her caused such anxiety to well in me that I had taken to severe bouts of vomiting. She was nearly impossible to avoid, though. Her blue-green eyes taunted me from all directions, trying my best to shut her out and preferring the familiarity of the contents of the buckets to her misleading beauty. I studied the mixture of bits of rice and undisturbed fish bones from the previous night's meal. They were the markers of our life. So long as we breathed, these buckets would be filled. Leaning back, I dipped the first bucket into the warm waters, keeping my eyes on the deck in front of me, following the lines of the wood grain. I felt her tongue brush against my fingers, lapping at the blistering salt seared there. I pulled back reflexively, causing the bucket to fall overboard. Swearing, I reached to retrieve the bucket. It was then that I caught it out of the corner of my eye, a smudge of blackness on the horizon, half dipped into the ocean, half set against the sky. I turned toward it, although it loomed over the sea. Within seconds, the vastness of the sea reached out and struck me flat across my face. A wave of nausea overwhelmed me as I was flooded with visions of my brother and sister devoured whole in our second attempt to escape Vietnam, and the faces of children shallow and starving, in the arms of their mothers who held them above water as they themselves were slowly pulled down, their legs entangled in the sea's slimy tresses. Nausea buckled my knees, dry heaving the dehydrated contents of my stomach onto the deck.
"What use is this child of yours?"
said a man near me. He gave me a disdainful look and then turned to seek out my mother, whom everyone had paid with blood and gold for the passage on our family's small rickety fishing boat. His scan of the deck was stopped short at the black mass that was once nothing more than a stain in the corner of the sky. It was gaining size as if it was absorbing the sky, the clouds, and the oceans around it.
"Row! Row the other way!"
my mother yelled.
"But that would take us back."
But the oncoming blackness motivated all hands. People rowed back towards the country we had fled. Try as we might, though, we could not travel as fast as the patch was growing. I felt paralyzed as I watched it consume everything around me, blanketing us in darkness. With it came a deafening howl, and the stench of sweetened rust filled my senses, pungent and sharp. But the black void brought something different, the distinct musk of human sweat perspired in desperation. At one time I had loved the sea. Every waking morning was filled with rituals of welcoming her waters, which always stayed damp on my skin. Nearly 10 years ago, when her father first purchased this boat, we had all looked towards her as our savior, a means to carry us away from Vietnam. Since we lost Khan and Chuk, though, she was nothing more to me than a cruel, deceitful being that could never be trusted. Our first attempt was foiled almost immediately by the police patrols along the shoreline. The patrol boat had forced us ashore, and all those passengers that did not dive into the waters had been shot on land. Several dozen people decimated within seconds. On our second attempt, we got as far as we are now, the South China Sea. On that trip, the fear of police had passed into the fear of pirates. We had been 6 days at sea, and our supplies were low. That was when she betrayed us. When we were at our weakest, when the human waste we threw overboard spoke of death and starvation, she let out her siren's call, and then they came, partners in treachery. They invaded our boat, carried away our food and supplies, captured all the women and girls. The screaming was manic, with people lunging, flesh and bone sacrificed to attempt to stop them. But they had strength and machetes, and we had nothing. It became a nightmare that ran on repeat in my head. My brother had charged at two men who had grabbed my sister. For this, the sea clambered up and claimed him. As they dragged us onto their ship, I grabbed my sister and dragged her overboard. The sea promptly pulled us down until we were both under our boat. I felt her hand loosen from me in the same instant that my consciousness slipped from me. When I awoke, I was lying on the deck, the sound of sobs all around me, my sister gone. My mother hovered above me, her graying hair disarrayed around her face, the body of my father, his face bearing the sharp laceration of a machete, in her arms. Despite all this, or in spite of it, 3 years after burying our father, we began anew, recruiting the same families that had once lost members with us. What else did we have to lose? Many thought we were cursed. All the more reason to flee. We had two choices: a country that had lost all respect for human rights, or the sea with her unpredictable melodies. Which was more treacherous? We chose the sea. On this third trip, only 25 people came with us. The boat felt oddly spacious, as if each individual had at least 5 extra inches of space in which to breathe. In past attempts, we had crammed 100 people into our tiny fishing boat. Every inch of space on the boat had been filled with a body, often sitting on top of each other, the hope of escape overriding the need for personal space. 200 total for both attempts. Fewer than 75 survived those, only to return to Vietnam, where they languished in prison for the treasonous act of attempting to escape. My mother and I were the last of our family of 5. We had nothing left to lose but each other. With no light, there were no markers of the days. Time rolled into itself, hour after hour, minute after minute, second after second, until it became irrelevant. We had among us a single box of matches and a few candles. Though their wicks were long, we conserved them, not knowing how long we'd wander in the dark void. It was on my watch that I realized that the candle, like my hunger, remained still, as if frozen in time. The wick seemed not to diminish, nor the candle wax to drip. The spoonfuls of salted rice I had eaten lay savored on my tongue and cooling in my belly, as if I had just swallowed it. And yet, in the next instant, I was hungry again, as if I had not eaten in a month, and the candle had burnt down almost to the end of its wick. When I rose to blow it out, for fear of losing our only source of light, I was once again staring at a candle that seemed to have been burning for only a moment. Like a story told in reverse, out of order and out of context, moments passed or were about to occur and occurred over and over again, as if they had just happened. I could not take the inconsistencies anymore. I retreated to the cabin underneath the deck, huddled among the children and elders where I sat numbly staring at blackness all around me. Mother poked her head down into the cabin from the deck.
"Child,"
she hissed. I ignored her.
"My child."
She marched down the steps, trampling over people as she made her way to me, peering right into my face, the flame of the candle in her hand burning my eyes. She pinched me hard, but still I refused to respond. What would be the purpose? The damn sea had won again. There was nothing that can explain the darkness above except our deaths.
"We are dead, Mother,"
I said.
"Dead."
"Hey, shut up and get up. I need your help."
She grabbed my arm and dragged me up to the deck. She was fierce, like a firefly, unwilling to be defeated. She attempted to lift me up, but gravity helped me stay dumb and motionless.
"No, Mother. There is nothing out there. No light, no life, no fish, no sound, nothing. We are on our journey to the next life. I want to see Father. I want to see Gan and Chuk again."
She slapped me then. It stung, and I blinked.
"Father would be ashamed of you," she said.
The words struck at me harder than her slap. I shook her off and started up the stairway into the impending darkness. Reaching the deck, a wave of intense anxiety overtook my senses. I could feel the sway of the water so much more strongly than below deck, and the boat leaned, tremulously unbalanced on one side. I searched for something to grasp onto as the feeling of sinking came over me. I whimpered and my knees gave out. I fell onto the deck. On deck stood and squatted all of the adults on the fishing boat. I should have been with them. I had come of age last year and was by far the strongest and tallest among them. I could see all this in my mother's fierce eyes, but instead I had chosen to cower among the elderly and the children, welcoming death to my side. At least there my family members would outnumber the living.
"We need you to help us bring down the broken mast. Its weight is making the boat lean into the water. If it falls, it will bash a hole in the hull."
"No, Ma, no, I can't."
Violent images began to flood me. Mother guided me to the mast that leaned to its side nearly cracked in half, but not quite broken all the way through. It hung over the side of the boat, pulling it into the water. People were furiously bailing water. The sight of water immediately threw me into a fit. I started wheezing, my eyes shut tight. I dropped to the ground again, pulling my arms around my head, blocking out the image of water pummeling me, water pulling Chuk and Kan into the sea. Mother shook me.
"This is our boat. This is our responsibility. You know this boat better than anyone here, and you are the right size. We are all too small. The children are too small. You are strong. You need to do this, or else this boat will sink."
I began to inch backwards. I felt my mother's arms around me trying to grab me, and I broke into a sprint until I reached the stairs. Before she could catch me, I made my way back down to the corner of the cabin where I pressed myself against the children there. Mother did not return. I sat with the children and elders, and we listened as the adults shouted commands above us. I clamped my hands over my ears, shutting out their voices, shutting out my cowardice. Then came yells and screams that I couldn't shut out, and a heavy splash onto the water. The boat rocked and shook as footsteps stomped on the deck, running back and forth. Then more shouts and splashing before a sudden, chilling silence. We all looked up, towards the opening, even though the darkness was so profound that we could see nothing. Then I heard my mother's wail. A pang of guilt stabbed at me, and I bolted up the stairs onto the deck, reckless of the wrenching in my belly. A frantic man accosted me.
This is your boat. We paid you to take us on this hellish trip. Get up and do something, or you'll see your mother die. What kind of ungrateful child are you?
Pushing him aside, I ran onto the deck. For the first time since the darkness had descended upon us, the deck was completely illuminated with a bright light that seemed to come out of nowhere. The strong smell of sweet iron filled my nostrils, and a chill seeped into my bones. Before me, rising rapidly from the water, was a serpentine creature glowing silver and massive in proportion. The whipping lashes of the sea framed it on all sides. It roared as loud as thunder, echoing with tortured voices. At the very top of the beast was the face of a man, a small and severely disproportionate to the rest of the creature's body. Thin as a skeleton, the hollow of the man's cheeks caved inward while his mouth distended unnaturally. He reached two long arms down towards Mother, who was hanging onto the tip of the broken mast, a butcher's knife poised in her hand.
Mother!
I screamed, remorse vibrating violently on my tongue as I realized that she sat where I was supposed to be, doing what I had refused to do. I scrambled up the mast, attempting to reach her. Several men and women grabbed oars and hacked at the monstrosity. With each strike, limbs sprouted along the monster's torso, arms, legs, and hands distended from its trunk. Mother stabbed her knife at the man, reaching down towards her. I inched closer to her, but the sweat and slime of the sea and my own anxiety created a slippery coat on the mast, forcing me to slide down. To accompany the disjointed limbs, faces emerged from the beast's body, each grotesquely pulled back as if stretched too far. They peered at us, screaming words that were blended one into each other. Their voices dripped of grief and sorrow, speaking of the dream we all had, of escape, of freedom. Faces wavered in and out, faces I knew well. Nghĩa, Thuy, Ngọc, Bình, Khánh.
Khánh? Mother, it's Khánh?
I caught Mother's confused expression. In that moment, a man directly in front of me pierced his oar deep into the creature, sinking it between the faces of two villagers that had once lived side by side, both lost to the sea in our last attempt to escape. Their faces scrunched up in pain. For an instant, their voices became clear, calling my mother by her name. Different tones, different dialects, different pitches, but all the same name. Mother wrapped herself around the broken mast. The arms of the man at the top of the creature elongated, grabbing Mother, tearing the broken mast from the boat. The boat swayed backwards, sending everyone on deck tumbling. Mother's face twisted in pain as her torso and legs were swallowed by the mutilated human appendages, the trail of a tear etching a faint scar along her cheek. Within seconds, she disappeared into the creature. Almost as suddenly as it appeared, it sank swiftly into the water, taking its glow deep into the abyss, leaving us shrouded in total darkness. Once again, I had been inches away when the sea stole someone from me. I stood and screamed out at her with all the rage in my being.
Give her back to me!
For durations I cannot remember, the instances of my mother's disappearance, of arriving on deck to see her perched on top of the mast, of staring at the tumble of arms and legs and tormented faces, replayed itself out of order. Around me, people began screaming as they slipped in and out of what happened, what was happening, and what was about to happen. Attempting to avoid insanity, we talked ourselves through each interval of time, moving collectively so that we could prevent madness from tearing at our minds. When I could grab cognizance of the now, it felt as if I was taking a seat within my own body. As soon as confusion passed us, and it was evident that we were in the present, someone would shout,
"Now!"
Everyone would throw themselves into motion, trying to get as much done as possible, preparing food, feeding the children, the various tasks of staying alive. Everything we did became paramount to losing our minds. We became more and more cognizant of when we were, of the instant moment, and when we would fall out of it. I sharpened oars and created makeshift weapons. I darted back and forth from the deck to the cabin to check on the children who ran in circles, unable to cope with the ever-changing slippages in time. And the elders who sat holding their heads.
What's happening to us?
They moaned to each other. Excrement, urine, and bile lay strewn haphazardly in the cabin. No one cared anymore to use the buckets, their minds a field of havoc. I packed the raw pieces of their innards into the buckets, feeling the familiar comfort of their stench relaxing me in between intervals of my own memory lapses. It came again several times again. Each time we fought it off, our sharpened oars piercing through it, and each time it claimed more members of our boat. The last time it came, the deck was full of children and elders. Our inattention to hygiene in wake of all that had happened had started to produce sores on the skin of the children. Children were brought up to be bathed with salt water. The same was done for elders. It was in this instance, when every child was on deck and running about naked, glistening, salty, and clean, and elders were being escorted upstairs, that the sweet stench of iron filled the air.
"It's coming!"
I yelled. The children were rushed downstairs, and the elders were carried one by one into the cabin below. Those on deck grabbed their makeshift weapons and readied themselves. A roar broke from the waters of the sea, and rising once again in a pitiful wail was the creature framed by a tidal wave of water. Voices screamed from within the wave, arms reached out and faces pressed forward, changing between expressions of grief and happiness. Each face cried the name of a person on board, and random limbs and fingers reached out, brushing up against our skin, attempting to grab us. Then a woman's face emerged, soft and flattened, beautiful almost. Staring down on the deck, she wailed,
"Grandmother!"
and reached her arms out to an elder who had been left behind. The elder screamed up at the woman, sobs coming from out of her chest and crest.
"My child! My child!"
she cried. Her arms reached out to the woman.
"No!"
I yelled, running to block the girl's descent.
"I want to go with her!"
sobbed the elder. The girl's face flitted in and out of distortion until she looked just as she did when I last saw her. It was our second attempt. She had jumped, like me, like Kan. The sea had grabbed her. I remembered her face sinking below the water.
"Moy,"
I said.
"Moy was your name."
She smiled then, and it was neither unnatural nor terrifying. Before I could stop her, the elder jumped up and grabbed Moy, pulling her back onto the boat. Arms reached out to cling onto the elder. We pulled her back onto the deck, but her hold on Moy was steadfast. She pulled until Moy fell onto the deck, and behind her tumbled a line of people who had held onto Moy's legs. More people squeezed through the beast's torso, trying to follow Moy.
"Grab them! Grab them!"
yelled the elder as she reached for the faces that appeared from the creature, pulling at arms and hands. Her strength seemed amazing. One by one, people tumbled, children, infants, adults, crying, smiling, relief thick in their voices. I dropped my oar and grabbed at arms and faces. Others stared at us in horror, but when the bodies of people, naked and smiling, appeared, they all joined in, pulling more and more bodies out of the creature. Oars were dropped, knives were thrown into the sea, and the boat became a clamor of arms reaching out to grab at hands, fingers, toes, hair. I called out the names of my family.
"Kan, Juk, Mother."
I heard myself echoed in the voices all around me as people yelled out the names of loved ones they had lost. One by one, they tumbled from the creature that hovered over our boat. The creature shrank and slimmed with each person that we pulled out, transforming back into nothing more than a tidal wave dangling frozen above our boat. Then a face emerged, a face I knew like the back of my hand. Kan, my sister. I grabbed her. She fell onto me, bursting into sobs, burying her face into my neck, her hair long and twining about her body. From within the wave, we had pulled out nearly 100 people. We sat like sardines on the deck, passing a candle back and forth, identifying faces, calling out names. I sat staring at my brother and my sister, as my mother held on to them both. Beyond them were the faces of people dear to me, people I had passed every day in our village, people I had convinced myself to forget because missing them was too painful. Voices continued forever into the darkness as people spoke, whispered, cried about a haven, the sea's safe harbor. Had it been like this all this time, that the sea had been a solace for lost souls all along? Going back and forth between trying to catch glimpses of my family and the wavering movement of the candle, I curled my fingers into the sea. In the sheath of the darkness, I made my peace with her. When the darkness parted, fading into the soft blush of dawn, the fear that had plagued us all left us suddenly as it had came. Screams and yelps of relief broke out as sunlight filtered through the darkness. Though I hid my face, I knew the sea was opening all around me. The musical lapping of her waves were drowned out only partially by the celebratory cacophony of the passengers. Fearing an episode, I drew my attention to the deck, focusing on the ragged, worn lines of the wood as it trailed old stories. I drew down closer to it, squatting until all I could see was feet. I watched the interplay of small feet with big feet, heavy feet, tiny feet, all walking, running, jumping, dancing. A familiar hand rested on my back, then a head, gray hair falling into my face, tears soaking warm on my torn shirt. She came into full view, and I remembered how beautiful my mother was. I wrapped myself around her, becoming a child again. I let myself cry, darkening her shirt with sobs for all those faces I did not see, those that were not returned to us, those not taken into the protection of the sea, like father. Her arms curled around my body and we held on to each other. Kan and Chuk joined us, tangling their limbs in ours.
Open your eyes,
Kan laughed at me. I peeked open one eye and spied the vastness of the blue sea. I expected to be curled into myself within an instant, dry heaving onto the deck. But instead, waves of calmness washed through me. The sea was winking bright flashes of sunlight at me, her arms spread wide and inviting. I took a deep breath and opened both my eyes. The end.
And welcome back. The author revealed to us that this is an own voices story that highlights the experience of Vietnamese boat people, many of whom risked their lives and the lives of their children to search for freedom which they were not able to find in their home country. For many refugees that flee persecution by sea, the ocean itself becomes an enemy. The author writes from a place of experience and has lost family to this kind of situation. Quinn writes, I have lost many more of my people by sea, and this story pays homage to them and to the dream that somewhere in a special limbo space, they have all been waiting patiently to be found. It is a story about the plight of refugees and how the discrimination in our own country against them is just one part of a narrative of struggle. Thank you for that, Zora. If you're interested in more works by Vietnamese and Vietnamese diaspora writers, I invite you to check out Allison Tai's story, Caring for Dragons and Growing a Flower, Nhi Vo's story, The Ghost Years, and Aliette de Bodard's work on Escape Pod. And that was our show for this week. On behalf of everyone here at Podcastle, our audio engineer Peter Baravesh, our forum moderator Aussie Cat, your co-editors Jen Albert and Sheree Clark, along with all of our wonderful first readers, like Tierney Bailey, Sophia Barker, Matt Dovey, Aidan Doyle, Amelia Harrington, Kai Hudson, Craig Jackson, Julian Jarbo, Shamari Kirkwood, Devin Martin, Julia Pat, Hamilton Perez, Shrikupa Krishna Prasad, Ziv Witties, Eleanor Wood, and Caitlin Zivanovich. Thank you for letting us share another story with you. Podcastle is part of Escape Artists Incorporated and is distributed under the Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives 4.0 International License. Feel free to share it, but don't sell it or change it. Our music is by Shiva in Exile. Everything we do on Podcastle is 100% donor funded, and if you'd like to support what we do, I invite you to join us on our Patreon at patreon.com/EAPodcasts. We'll be back next week with another tale. See you then.